Tom King, California rock art expert Alan Garfinkel, and the Man in the Hat, all on this week's CRM Archaeology Podcast. Hello and welcome to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 32 for April 21st, 2014. I'm your host, Chris Webster. Today we feature an interview with Tom King. Tom discusses his new book from Left Coast Press, and we talk about CRM reality show possibilities and the future of Section 106 and the National Historic Preservation Act. We also have a great interview that I recorded with Dr. Alan Garfinkel at the Society for California Archaeology meetings last month. Dr. Garfinkel is a California rock art expert, a CRM archaeologist, and has written several books and numerous publications on rock art. He's even debuting a new documentary film right now about the Coso rock art on the China Lake Naval Weapons Facility near Barstow, California. Finally, we have two installments of our Profiles in CRM segment. I hope to get many more in Austin this week, so if you see me coming at you with a microphone, don't go running away. Sorry the podcast is a little late today. I was up all night doing last-minute edits to the Blogging Archaeology book that Doug and I are putting together. The book will be available as a free download on Saturday, April 26th, just in time for the Blogging Archaeology session at the SAAs in Austin. Also, the first copy of my new book came in the mail on Friday. It's called Field Archaeologist Survival Guide, Getting a Job and Working in CRM Archaeology, and it's available from Left Coast Press. They'll have copies at the SAAs if you're going to be there. They also want me to do a book signing on Friday afternoon, which is a little weird. The time will be announced when the time gets closer. It will be at the Left Coast table in the exhibit hall. Keep an eye on Twitter for details. Regarding Twitter, I'll be tweeting from @ArcheoWebby, that's ArcheoWebby, and everyone should be tweeting with the hashtag SAA2014. If you download the new SAA application, which is pretty good actually, for your smartphone or tablet, they have a section where you can view all of the SAA 2014 tweets. One last thing, I'll be spending time at booth 123 in the exhibit hall. That's one of my new companies called Field Tech Designs. The other owner, Theron, and I will be showing off our digital site recording techniques, and we'll be fielding questions about our upcoming application that we're having developed. Stop by and say hi, and play with our toys. So don't forget to tell your friends and colleagues about the show. If you have a question, feel free to tweet us using the hashtag CRMArcPodcast. Or you can email me at ArcheoWebby, that's ArcheoWebby, @gmail.com. You can also use the contact form on the website located at www.digtech-llc.com/podcast. If you're working, then keep an ear out for your crew chief while you listen to the show. If you're not working, then go pick up a copy of my new book, because the CRM Archaeology Podcast starts right now. Everybody, so we are here with Tom King, noted author of multiple publications. We will have links to his blog and email and things like that in the show notes, so check those if you want more information. But we are going to get right into a few topics today that Tom and I talked about beforehand. And the first one we're going to talk about is what most people have probably heard of in the last week or so, which is the controversy leading up to and then the cancellation or indefinite postponement, whatever they're going to call it, of National Geographic Channel's Nazi War Diggers show. So, Tom, I had a question for you just to kind of get your opinion on this. Why do you think shows like this tend to succeed with the public? Obviously, this one didn't succeed because industry sort of rose up and said, you can't do this. And the channel listened, but there's other shows that have succeeded and they're still on the air and the public seems to like it. Do you think there's something that we're doing wrong, or do you think there's just the kind of thing the public seems to like?
Well, I think it's something I suppose archaeologists are doing wrong in terms of being too self-satisfied and righteous. I mean, the public likes to see people find stuff. And what do you think makes the Indiana Jones movies popular? Not that he's doing great science. He's not doing great science. He's finding stuff and having adventures, and people like to see that. And that's a very human motivation. So I don't think it's at all surprising that, that shows like that are popular. What's surprising is that we continue to take umbrage at them and just deplore them rather than trying to figure out how to work with them.
Well, so that leads me to the other question. You know, the show Time Team, the BBC version was incredibly popular in the UK, and the American version is not quite as popular. I don't know if that's because it's playing on PBS or if it's their marketing or what, but I'm wondering if Time Team would be more popular if it were on a more popular channel. And why isn't it on a more popular channel? Because everybody seems to like Time Team. They seem to do everything mostly right. They kind of rush through stuff because they have a limited time frame, but they do find stuff and they get a chance to present science at the same time. So I don't know. What do you think about that?
Well, I have to admit that I've not seen Time Team, which I suppose says something, but I haven't seen Nazi Diggers either. I don't watch very much television. And so I really can't say anything very intelligent about it. I do think that a show that does a responsible job of depicting how people find stuff and how people learn from the past could be popular. But of course, a lot does have to do with where it's being shown, what channel it's being shown on. But again, this is not where I have any particular expertise.
Okay. Well, you know, I actually told Ashley I wasn't going to bring this up, but I'm going to just briefly. Because, Tom, you and I have been talking with some other people on one of the Facebook groups about the possibility of, or not necessarily the possibility, we were just kind of hypothesizing, you know, would a sort of a CRM reality show ever work? You know, would anybody watch that? And would it get anything done? Would it just be full of drama? Or, you know, would they have the opportunity to actually show some of the process that we go through in this industry, not just the archaeology, but the entire process from start to finish? And, you know, I wonder if you think it could be written in a way to be interesting. I mean, it seems like the public needs a little drama. And as we all know, there's plenty of that on any given project. But it seems like it would also be a vehicle for some information to get out to the public. Do you think it would ever work, or do you think it's an idea that's just not going to ever work?
Well, I think a lot gets back to how you define CRM. If you define it as walking around on transects recording archaeological sites and picking up potsherds or something, then no, there's not a snowball's chance in Nevada that it's going to go anywhere. But I think that if you looked at it, at CRM as what I think it really ought to be, there's a lot of excitement. I mean, I think about some of the cases that I've worked on that have really involved communities fighting to save things that were important to them, Indian tribes fighting to save places that are important to them. There's lots that could be made into interesting shows, and whether that was done as a reality show kind of thing or as a straight drama, I don't know. But I would think, yeah, there'd be ways to make the real process of CRM, what ought to be the real process of CRM, interesting to the public and attractive. And I think there's a lot out there that people are just not learning about that it would be nice if they were learning about.
Right. Absolutely.
Hey, Tom, I have a question for you about that. A concern I have with having some sort of CRM archaeology reality TV series is the risk of over dramatizing events that would not further relationships that, you know, the process, the federal process, especially Section 106 and consultation aims to strive for. So that's really where I see a concern with having a reality TV series. And I just wonder, you know, would we really be showcasing the relationship building like you're describing it? Or, you know, my concern just that it would it wouldn't further it as the way I'd like to, you know, like it to see.
I don't know. You're being too abstract for me. I'm not understanding what your problem is. What is it you're afraid of?
Well, I think, you know, if I was running, had a project, and so many projects are already tension, many of them are tension filled because we're often enough brought in at a stage in which constructors or contractors haven't done the Section 106 process appropriately, and we've been brought in a later stage and trying to do damage assessment, you know, I see a concern for, you know, having this television series saying, here we are, we're going to save this project and, you know, this and that. And the concern of, you know, the contractors as well, in illustrating, you know, look, we're coming in and we're saving and doing all this, as opposed to, you know, the relationship building that we're also trying to further, if I'm being at all any more articulate.
Well, I mean, if I'm hearing you right, you're concerned about the fact that we very typically have project proponents who aren't really pursuing the process the way it is that Congress intended it to be pursued. They're waiting until the last minute, and then they're calling in the professionals and they're saying, here, get us out, get us through this silly process. At the last moment, after we've made all the decisions, after we're ready to crank up the bulldozers and knock down the buildings and tear out the neighborhood and rip out the sacred sites and bulldoze the archaeology, now you guys come in here and you fix all this. And if we reveal that to the public, it's going to upset people. Well, what do you know? It's going to upset people. That, I think, is the point. You know, I've lived with this profession since its initiation, and we are still dealing with the same bloody problems that we were dealing with 50 years ago. And a lot of them have to do with the fact that the project proponents start late, start stupid, make up their minds before they ever call on anybody to look at the impacts of the project, and then expect the professionals to somehow bail them out. And that, I think, is exactly the drama that would be good for the public to understand and good to have revealed to the public. And yeah, it would sure make some people uncomfortable. And I'd say that they need to be uncomfortable.
See, and that's why I don't think you'd be able to find a firm that would be willing to do that.
Exactly. Put their career and their firm on the line like that.
Well, and look at what you're saying about this so-called profession. You're basically saying that everybody's a crook and everybody's on the take. And nobody would be willing to be truthful about the situation that they confront. Now, that may very well be true. In fact, you probably are absolutely right. But if that is true, then I see no reason for this profession, if you can jokingly call it a profession, to continue at all. We ought to all go flip burgers at McDonald's. So, you know.
Well, but that speaks to a wider issue of professionalization, I would think. I think there's nothing wrong in a firm being concerned about, you know, trying to, I mean, not every reality series or documentaries, for that matter, show all parties in good light. It is an educational experience, But that being said, I think, you know, it is a real concern. How much do you want to try to put yourself out there? And
sure, it's a concern. Of course, it's a concern. And I'm sure you're right that there's probably not a CRM firm in the country that would actually participate in an honest look at the underside of this profession.
Now, I don't think. Now, hang on. Now, I don't think that there's a underside to this profession. I don't think there's an underside in the way that you're suggesting there's an underside. I think the problem is that a lot of the big firms, the big firms that are able to make the lower bids and the woefully underestimated time bids, they're the ones who would be the ones most likely to participate in a show like that because they could afford it. Because the show's going to cost, if you were to do something like that, it would cost whatever firm decided to participate money. And the larger firms are notorious for doing things like underbidding and overpromising. But I think if you could get some smaller firms, some up-and-coming smaller firms to participate, I think you would see a whole different level of professionalism and a whole different level of work ethic there, because the smaller firms are more concerned about doing the job properly and doing it within a realistic amount of time. But they're the one, but you don't see them very often because they get overlooked because of the bigger firms who frankly screw things up sometimes.
Let me jump in on that real quick. I have an incredibly small firm since I just started it 14, 15 months ago and haven't really done a whole lot of work yet. So I'm not even sure I qualify, but I would certainly jump on top of something like this and use it as a vehicle to promote sort of the good side of our profession and show people how we do things. I think the problem lies with the clients personally. I think you'd be hard pressed to find clients, at least out here in the West. They're often mining companies or other agencies and things like that, and they're too secretive as it is. You can't even talk about the project typically, let alone air it on national TV.
Right.
So that would be a concern out here. I don't know about the East Coast, where you might be just dealing with a Walmart or something like that
Walmart would not be okay with something like
yeah,
that.
Well, that's true.
Not even a little
yeah,
bit.
That's true too.
Well, I mean, you guys seem to be assuming that this is something that would be financed by the change agent, by the project proponents, and I think that's a bizarre thing to assume. That isn't going to happen because there's nothing in it for them. You might get a television operation, you know, like National Geographic or something, to sponsor such a thing. But it certainly is not going to be sponsored by the Walmarts or the mining companies or the energy companies. There's no rationale for them to do it.
Well, and I wasn't necessarily talking about sponsoring, but just their participation at all, because it's their, you know, whoever's project you're working on, whoever the client is, would have to, say, reveal some information about the fact that they're looking into a property for whatever reason.
Now, aren't most of your projects, since particularly they're in the West, isn't there federal involvement in them? Isn't the federal agency? Well, all right.
Yeah,
federal agencies are supposed to be public servants, right?
Right.
Public servants ought to be open to doing this kind of thing. But of course they're not. We all know they're not. We all know that they're not going to do anything that the project proponents aren't going to allow. So you're probably right that it can't be done. But I don't think that means that it's not a desirable thing.
Right.
And so if it's desirable, then maybe you look for ways that it can be done. And, you know, maybe there are ways to, if you make it not a reality show, but more of a traditional drama, if you will,
mm-hmm.
Maybe that works. Maybe that's a possibility. I don't know. This, again, is not something that I do. But I think it's something that would be interesting to try to explore with people in media. But one would have to sort of look at a variety of possibilities, not just assume that it's going to be sort of a takeoff on Time Team or something.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, we're gonna move on from this. I wanted to talk about it because every time one of these shows had come up, there's been talk online about why isn't there a CRM reality show and why there shouldn't be and why there should be. So I at least wanted to get it in there and discuss it just a little bit. So let's move on. And Tom, I'll give you a chance to sort of plug your new book that you've co-authored with Claudia Nisley. I'm looking at it right here. I haven't had a chance to read it. I've skimmed through it. I just picked it up at the California meetings last week. And for the audience, the book is called Consultation and Heritage, Let Us Reason Together. So Tom, why don't you give us a quick idea of, if you can give us a quick idea of what this is about and who the audience is for this book. Who did you write it for?
Well, the audience, there are a couple of audiences, but basically it's people doing things like CRM, not just CRM and not just in the United States. It's designed for an international audience, but people dealing with cultural heritage in the environment and working in the kind of industry that we all work in. And for citizens, for people in the community who are interacting with that industry, trying to get their cultural heritage taken care of. And really, the book is very, very simple. It doesn't say anything profound. It just says, look, there are laws out there that say that you consult. And consultation means something other than just sending a letter, having a meeting, saying, ho-hum, thank you for your comments, and now we will go do what we had decided to do in the first place. Consultation is supposed to be a back-and-forth street in which people reason together. That's from Isaiah 18-something or other. And we reason together to reach some kind of agreed-upon conclusion. And unfortunately, even though there are innumerable laws and regulations and guidelines and executive orders that talk about consultation, almost nobody seems to know how to do it in a reasonable way. And so that's what the book's about. It's just a simple primer on how to do consultation.
So how does this compare, to compare it to another book that you've got that's been out for a little while, and I actually did read this one, Saving Places That Matter. How does this compare to the information in that book? And I know that was written, if I remember right, more for the somebody...
Traditional cultural properties, right?
Yeah, I know you talk about that in that book, but how does that book compare to this book? Let's just put it that way.
Well, Saving Places That Matter was basically a guide to the Section 106 process for people in communities. And tried to explain the Section 106 process in simple language. The consultation book is about consultation, whether it's being done under 106 or as part of NEPA or in some international context. I mean, one of the example we use of the consequences of failing to consult is the case of Gezi Park in Istanbul. And, it's a classic case where you make up your mind, you decide what you're going to do, and all of a sudden you find people out in the street with Molotov cocktails.
Right.
That can be avoided, ought to be avoided, if one just treats people with a modicum of respect. And that's really what the book's about.
All right. Well, We maybe when a few more of us have read it, we'll have you back on and talk about it some more.
Sure. We'll have Claudia. Claudia is a very eloquent speaker on the subject.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. We might even be able to get you both on here. For now, a lot of people listening to this are likely going to the SAAs, judging from the online traffic we've seen. So if you're going there, I bought this at the Left Coast Press booth at the California meetings. I know they're going to be at the SAAs, and I know they'll probably have a bunch of copies there. So stop by and check it out.
Sure. Please
okay.
Do.
Let's move on to a topic that I think might take a little bit of time to discuss, and that is the impending National Historic Preservation Act anniversary. As most people probably know, it was enacted in 1966, so 2016 will be the 50-year anniversary of NHPA. And Tom, I know you've written and talked extensively about NHPA Section 106. I mean, you've literally written the book on Section 106 several times, I think. So what do you think, like, what's your best case scenario if they gave you the keys to NHPA and said, Tom, we want you to rewrite this thing or destroy it entirely and write something else? What would be your best case scenario for what would happen in 2016 or sooner or later or whenever to either revise or modify or get rid of it entirely?
At this point, well, I won't say I'd get rid of it entirely, though I sometimes do say that. I would certainly get rid of the existing system. It seems to me that we have focused so much on the sort of silly, irrelevant parts of the National Historic Preservation Act and so downgraded the important parts that the system is hardly worth saving. But of course, what we will have for the 50th anniversary is all the usual players patting themselves on the back about what a wonderful system it is. And that's, I suppose that's in the nature of birthday celebrations. But I would like to see us look more critically at not only what has worked from a variety of perspectives, but notably what has not worked and what has not really gone the way that the founders thought it was supposed to go. And I don't think at this point that the law is working very well at all. I may be a minority in that respect, but I don't think that it's a success. And I don't think we ought to be celebrating it as a success.
So what do you think is it, what do you think it's been its biggest failing? Like where is it failed the most?
I think it's failed the most by focusing on an elitist institution, the National Register of Historic Places. It has allowed this a small coterie of narrow professionals to define what constitutes the heritage of the nation and its communities, and how that heritage ought to be taken care of. And that's too bad. It's too bad for the nation because we've basically left the people who really value that heritage out in the cold, and basically generally left their heritage unprotected. And it's bad for, in the long run, for those of us who are making a living in the operation, because we don't have the public support that we would have if we had a more public-oriented program. So that would be the big change that I'd make if I had the ability to do so, would be to really focus on taking care of the things that are important to people rather than the things that are important just to archaeologists, just to architectural historians, just to historians, and so on.
Yeah, no, I kind of had a similar question for you, Tom, in kind of teasing specifics out of you. Would you consider canning certain aspects like integrity or the criteria in which we work with?
It's deeper than that. I think we should not have a system that drives people to construct the significance of places in terms of specific criteria that are issued by the federal government. It seems to me that if a group of people value a place, it is the federal government's business to pay attention to that place, not necessarily to preserve it, not necessarily to protect it, not necessarily to put money into it, but to pay attention to it. You know, the bottom line in the National Historic Preservation Act is that if it's a historic place, then you got to deal with it under Section 106. And yeah, there are grant programs and things like that, but the basic core of the program, the core of the act, is that the federal government, before it makes a decision about something, has to consider its effects on historic places. Well, it seems to me that the federal government, as the servant of the people by, for, and of whom the government is supposed to be made up, ought to pay attention to whatever it is that people think is important. And it shouldn't take the Secretary of the Interior of the National Park Service to decide whether something is eligible under Criterion C or Criterion D. I mean, that's just silly. And it's a waste of time. We have generated a huge bureaucracy that spends its time figuring out which letter grade to assign to places. When what we ought to be doing is simply trying to resolve disputes over how places ought to be treated, whatever places people think are important.
Speaking of the huge bureaucracy, that was a question I thought about while you were talking about that. Was is there an agency or group of agencies, or maybe all agencies, anything involved with either setting regulations or enforcing existing regulatory procedures that you would just get rid of entirely, or combine, or possibly change? Because I know you've had some pretty strong feelings about the National Park Service and possibly some other agencies. So how would you change that?
Well, if I had my druthers, and again, I obviously don't have my druthers, and I'm not going to have my druthers, but if I were able to do it, I would certainly take the program out of the National Park Service. It never belonged there, and it certainly doesn't belong there now. The Park Service has gotten much, much, much worse over the last 30 years or so in managing its part of the program. The Advisory Council is no great shakes either, but I think the biggest problems lie with the National Park Service, not in the parks. You know, Park Service does fine with the parks. Let them go do the parks. That's what they like to do. That's what they're good at doing. That's what they ought to do. But for heaven's sake, get them out of the business of trying to relate to the real world. They are no good at it.
So, Tom, I'm going to finish with one more question. We've got a new segment that we're trying out called Profiles in CRM. And I really just want to ask you the last question that I have in that little series, which is, because I know you worked in CRM early on in your career, right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what you're calling CRM.
Well, you're right. Okay. Well, let me just ask you this then and see how you'd like to answer it. What one piece of advice, if you could only give one piece of advice to an undergraduate in an anthropology program right now that wants to get into the field of CRM as an archaeologist, what piece of advice would you give them as to maybe a course of study or something to pay attention to, or, you know, run for the hills? what if you could only give them one piece of advice, what would that be?
Oh, get outside the anthropology department, certainly get outside archaeology, look at courses in geography, in history, in planning, interdisciplinary courses. The field is not about archaeology. Archaeologists have to get over the idea that what CRM is applied archaeology. That's one of the things that's killing the whole operation.
Well, that is fantastic that you say that, because I wish somebody had told me that. I think the biggest class that I really wish I would have minored in it would be geology. I mean, how much, even just strictly the archaeology side of things, you know, there's so much that we have to do with geology, even if it's just, say, site formation processes and things like that. But even going, you know, a step further in excavations, and we you know, we've got to look at all the stratigraphy and things like that. And it's just, it's all sort of on the job information, but it's a huge part of what we need to know. And it's that fact is not made known when you're an undergraduate or even in grad school for that matter. So I'm glad you said that.
that that has nothing to do with cultural resource management. That's geology is a good skill to have, just like building screens is a good skill to have, but it is not intrinsic to the process of cultural resource management.
Right, and I see your point on that one. Right, for sure. All right, let's see. We have one more question. Sarah's asking in the background here. And this is probably good for you, Tom, because you've kind of alluded to this already, and I've seen you mention these things online. Anytime somebody says CRM archaeology, you know, you have something to say about that, because CRM is not just archaeology. So if you want to just define for our audience and for the podcast right now, how would you define cultural resource management? I mean, if it doesn't take a 600-page book to do it.
Managing cultural resources and managing impacts on cultural resources. But you got to recognize that cultural resources means resources that are important to culture. And that can be archaeology, that can be buildings, that can be landscapes, that can be sacred sites, that can be dance forms, that can be belief systems, that can be poetry, that can be music, that can be ethnobotany, that can be all manner of languages, a whole host of things, all the things that are important to culture. And one of the terrible things we've done is to take this perfectly good term, cultural resource management, and define it as applied archaeology, or sometimes sort of applied archaeology and maybe a couple of other things. And that's really too bad, because we're letting the bulk of culture then go unconsidered at all in federal planning.
That's true. That's true. I know just all the places I've worked across the country, the entire focus on the project is the archaeology. And
sure.
And there's not even a mention of looking into anything else. So
Yeah, no, I agree as well, because there should be so much more ethno history, ethnobotany, ethno everything incorporated in so many projects, or, you know, oral histories, and many, many projects are trying to address that. But there's a lot more, there's a lot broader scope that we can fold things into the project insights to help, as you say, preserve and manage the resources.
Yeah, well, I agree with that. I just think that we've got a system that is so designed to cater to and be administered by archaeologists and historians and architectural historians, following narrow-minded criteria that drive most ordinary people to just roll their eyes and fall under the table. But that, as long as it's set up that way, it really can't engage the broader aspects of culture.
Okay, well, I think we're going to leave it right there. Thanks, Tom, for answering our questions and being patient.
Thank you. My pleasure. Always happy to blather.
All right. Sounds good. Well, okay. Like I said, maybe in a few months we'll get you and Claudia on to discuss this book a little further once it's been out there for a little while.
Okay. So, we'll consult about that. Thank you.
All right, Tom. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Bye.
Sure.
Thanks.
Bye.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks. Bye.
This is CRM.
Okay, so this is Profiles in CRM, and I'm here with at the Society for California Archaeology meetings with a field tech I have worked with in the past, and we'll start off with the questions. What is your name? And I have who do you work for on here, but choose to answer that as you please.
Oh, well, let's see. Well, I guess for my name, I could just say the guy in the hat.
The guy in the hat with the pipe?
Maybe.
That's too much detail. Way too much detail. I think the voice is too much detail for people that know you listening
to
this podcast.
That's why I don't really care. I just wanted to add that.
All right. So how long have you been working in CRM archaeology?
Oh, God. I think, I want to say 2009.
2009. So did you go in right after you graduated from college? You went straight into CRM?
No, I graduated in 2008, which was like the perfect time to not get a job.
Yeah, that was right in the crash time, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So, all right. So, when you're working in CRM, what position do you usually have? Like, what's your? I'm trying to get a sense of what your current, say, career level is.
Oh.
So, what position do you currently have, and what is the highest position you've ever held?
I want to say I've just been a regular fuel tech.
Okay.
I've never done any. Well, actually, I have done the GPS stuff, but no one's ever paid me more for it.
No, and I'm really mean like the traditional levels, like field tech, crew chief, project manager,
oh,
stuff
yeah, just
like
field
that.
Tech, then.
Yeah. So okay, that's going to be probably 90% of the people I talk to about this. And where have you worked? And by that I mean like what states or geographical regions?
Let's see. Basically, the Great Basin region, almost all of it. So I've worked all over Nevada. I worked in Idaho, Southern California. Oh, and I worked in Minnesota for a super long time.
That was just this last
necessary.
Summer, right?
Yeah, longer yeah. than necessary.
Right. What is the best thing that's happened to you that's related to being an archaeologist?
I think the only good thing that's ever happened, I can say, is that one time at the end of our survey day, we found a cooler full of beer, and it was the end of the day, so we could drink it. And it was buried in the woods at the bottom of a Jeep trail.
Nice.
And the PBR was not that bad. I mean, it was super old, but you know, wasn't that skunked.
Right. It was good enough for the end of the day, right?
Yeah.
All right. So, what is the biggest thing you would change that would make being a CRM archaeologist better?
Well, if you increase pay, you'd increase the quality of techs you get. I mean, you get what you pay for.
That's absolutely true.
I mean, people always say, I want, you know, you need people with master's degrees, but no one's going to invest in a master's degree if you just get paid like $2 or $3 an hour more than everyone else. I mean, you can try to change the standards all you want, but until you raise the pay, standards don't matter. You're never going to get people who want to be in this business, you know, who just want to be in it. You're just going to get weird sort of gentleman archaeologist at that point if you just change standards without raising pay.
That's a good point, because I've thought about that too. The, you know, I thought about my answer, and I would say somehow try to raise the quality of life for field techs, but raising the pay will do that.
It's the same thing.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's all tied to it.
Yeah, because, you know, you go home, and, you know, I mean, I was talking about this with someone the other day. You're basically paying them college student wages, and so you get people who live like, who, only people you get are people who are okay with living like a college student in their, like, 40s.
Right.
And, of course, you know, great archaeology happens when you're a college student in your 40s, obviously.
Absolutely. So what is your career goal in CRM? Like, where do you, I guess it's the where do you see yourself in 10 years question.
Oh, God. I totally want to, I want to get a degree in something else, something to do with computers, but something that can relate back to archaeology, because I know that things are getting automated. So I was thinking about this morning, actually. I was thinking, you know, they need IT people who can get all this stuff automated.
Mm-hmm. So you want to stay in archaeology, but maybe in a different sort of, not necessarily a fieldwork side of it, but maybe something related to archaeology.
Yeah, basically something where I can actually afford to buy a car and a house.
Maybe health insurance.
That too.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
So, last question. If you could give an undergrad that's listening to this, thinking about a career, quote-unquote, in CRM archaeology, what is one piece of advice you would give them?
Oh, well, God, I want to say there are two pieces, but I guess the main one is get used to living like a college student for the rest of your life. I mean, literally.
So if you had two pieces of advice, what would the other one be?
Take this job seriously, because there are people who definitely, like, are too trusting. They get into this and they think everyone's their friend, but a lot of people will be friendly to your face, but not necessarily behind it.
All right, this is Chris. I'm here with Dr. Alan Garfinkel, and we just finished an awesome morning at the Society for California Archaeology meetings with rock art panels, and we just finished a screening of his new film, Talking Stones, about Coso rock art. So, Dr. Alan Garfinkel.
Hey, Chris Webster. It's good to see you and DigTech LLC. You're here at the Society for California Archaeology, and we've been here for a few days now. I've been here for 3 days. My background, I began in archaeology, actually in high school. And from that time, I found that the discipline and the business of doing anthropology and archaeology interested me. I saw it was something you could actually do, because you can do archaeology as basically applied anthropology. And it struck me as interesting. I started off in doing field schools, one in Arizona, Saguaro National Monument, another one in Taos, New Mexico. And I was hooked. There was something about the profession and something about the study of anthropology that spoke to me. And I loved it. I became passionate about it and began to work in the field. I went to Cal State University Northridge for my bachelor's degree, did a four-year stint there, and actually just began to do archaeology from that time. It was during the 60s, and the environmental movement was going in, and there was some ways that we could actually do work there in the field, call it applied anthropology or salvage archaeology or environmental compliance, and I found it to be a lot of fun.
So this is primarily a CRM archaeology podcast, and I know that you've worked for a couple of big firms. So why don't you give everybody a little bit of your cultural resource management background?
You know, I've been consulting, doing freelance consulting for decades. So I began working with the Bureau of Land Management on an internship when I was doing graduate work at the University of California, Davis. But even earlier than that, or about that same time, I launched the Far Western Anthropological Research Group as sort of a graduate school. Before that, I did the Northridge Archaeological Research Center. I was going to Cal State Northridge. So I've always been consulting, freelance consulting, doing what they call cultural resource management for many, many years. But I've always been working as well or going to school, so it became part and parcel of what I did, but not full time. I worked for the BLM for a time, worked in the California Desert Planning Staff out of Riverside. I worked for the BLM in Bakersfield. I did contract work for the Forest Service and the BLM along the Pacific Crest Trail. I worked in the Western Mojave Desert on contract to do some excavations there, and then did some more Pacific Crest Trail work afterwards, way up in the uplands of the Kern Plateau and the far Southern Sierras. Then after that, I went and worked for two stints of 9 years apiece for the California Department of Transportation. They have one of the biggest cultural resource management expressions in all of California. About 120 people at one time were employed full-time professionally in the field of cultural resource management, and I was one of them.
Nice, nice. So one of the things we've been looking at today, like I mentioned at the beginning, was the Rock Art Panel symposium that you organized. And then we had a screening of your film for the Coastal Rock Art on the China Lake Naval Base down in Southern California, Eastern California. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got interested in rock art and then what led you to ultimately today getting this film produced?
You know, it's interesting because as I see it, life comes in circles. And sometimes serendipity, almost divine appointment, seems to step in. For whatever reason, there seems to be a tug on my life, and that tug seems to center on what I call Eastern California. Eastern California is kind of the nexus of the far Southern Sierra, the Tehachapis, the Western Mojave Desert, also the southwestern corner of the Great Basin. So in the area, I would call it the Isabella Basin or the Kern Plateau, Tehachapi Mountains, the area that they call Ridgecrest, Inyo Kern, Little Lake, all of those areas and the Tehachapis and Tehachapi itself have been sort of my home away from home. I have continuously done contract consulting and research work in that area for 40 years on and off. And what I found is as I go deeper and deeper into understanding the geographical connections of that area, things become clearer and clearer. I began working as a graduate student as an intern for the Bureau of Land Management. And they stationed me at Little Lake, and they wanted me to do a cultural resource management plan for a place they call Fossil Falls. There's no fossils and there's no waterfall, so that's a good name, Fossil Falls. But right there is the ancient corridor of the Pleistocene Owens River, where it ran through a basalt flow, a lava flow, and it plunges 100, 200 feet to the valley floor below. But that happened 10, 11, 12,000 years ago. So you have a dry waterfall that has all these beautiful little swirls and scours. And right there's an enormous archaeological area. And so it's sort of a wonderful little treasure. And I was able to protect it, develop a management plan to bar individuals from gathering up artifacts illicitly and going in there and perhaps vandalizing the area. So we put it on the National Register. I protected it, learned a bit about what they call Coso rock art at the time, because this is on the edge of the Coso Range, and lived in what was called the Little Lake Hotel. Little Lake has an enormous population of about 100 people on a good day, and it's in the shadow of Red Hill, a extinct red cinder cone volcano that exists right there.
So from something I was curious about, and something that others listening to this podcast, we get a lot of like undergraduate students and things like that, and new people in archaeology that might not know this. From a regulatory standpoint, the Coso rock art that you've studied, the stuff that's completely contained within the China Lake Naval Base, which you guys had to get access to get onto, not everybody can just get on there. How does that fit within the national and or state frameworks for regulations? Does Section 106 apply when they want to go out and do something there? Or does the military have their own set of regulations that they abide by?
You know, those are very good questions, very thoughtful questions. The land that exists within the China Lake Naval Weapons Center, all of the cultural resources, Section 106 applies because it's a federal area and it's federal guidelines and federal requirements. So whenever they do anything that would damage, impact, or disturb the landscape, they have to go out and do an inventory. They must evaluate the resources, document what's there, and consider whether those would have the characteristics necessary to be eligible for the National Register. If they find significant archaeological materials, be they historic or prehistoric, they have to develop ways to avoid and minimize damage to those sensitive cultural resources.
Okay, and I think I just have maybe one more question for you. If anybody listening to this wants to study rock art, maybe even just in Southern California, what sort of educational route, if let's say they're an undergrad right now, what sort of educational route and classes would you suggest they focus on? And are there any really good, say, graduate programs that you can recommend people check out for studying rock art?
You know, it's tough. There's very few places in California or even in the world that has a curriculum to study rock art. There's only been a handful of PhDs that have been completed with a specialty in rock art. University of California, Berkeley has had one recently. Mine that came out of UC Davis, a couple that came out of UCLA. There are rock art programs, but they're overseas, one in Australia and one in Africa. So it is a challenge to find an academic track to endorse or formally sort of, fulfill those areas of knowledge that one must have to really understand and document rock art. These days, one has to have a background in GIS, Geographic Information Systems. Digital technology is becoming more and more a part of rock art studies. So you have to be high tech, but also I would endorse having an understanding of anthropology, cultural anthropology, and really digging deep into the cognitive structure of native people, and also understand the nature of life ways, religion, cosmology, and the ideology of indigenous peoples, because that's what makes this stuff tick. That's what sort of puts the flesh and blood on the bones of sort of dead archaeology.
Awesome. So where can people find your research and your video?
I have a number of websites. DrAlanGarfinkel.com is one. I try to post a lot of my publications there. We also have a new organization dedicated to protection, interpretation, conservation of California rock art. It's californiarockart.org. Then we have a class, a deep dive into the mysteries of rock art called Rock Art 101, and that's at petroglyphs.us and rockart101.com. I also post all my stuff on academia.edu, so you can find it there. And barring any of that, send me an email, avram1952@yahoo.com.
And we will have all those links in the show notes so you don't have to memorize them. Thanks, Dr. Alan Garfinkel.
This is CRM.
Hi, everybody. It's Ashley Morton with the CRM Archaeology Podcast, and I am at the Northwest Anthropological Conference, and I am interviewing Ian Lewis with Equinox Research and Consulting. Ian, thanks for taking a couple minutes to interview. And so I'll start with, how long have you been working in CRM?
I've been with this company for about 2 years now.
And that's...
This is the first company that I've worked for, so
okay.
2 years to go.
And what is the position you have with Equinox?
A professional archaeologist.
Okay. And do you usually have... this is the highest position you've attained so far, right? Since
yeah.
you've been doing it for 2 years now. What is the best thing that's happened to you that's related to being an archaeologist?
The best thing that has happened to me was a particular site in Bellingham, actually, where there were booby traps. And all archaeology textbooks will tell you it's not like Indiana Jones, and there's no such thing as X marks the spot and booby traps, but there are. And it was fun to prove that wrong when I almost fell into a giant pit.
So. Well, what about OSHA then, huh?
What?
What about OSHA?
The safety standards?
I'm just being silly.
There was lots of sharp, twisted rebar. It reminded me of a tiger trap.
All right, so let's see here. What is the biggest thing you would change that would make being a CRM archaeologist better?
One thing that I found coming into this profession out of school is that some of my undergraduate classes I feel could have prepared me better for actual CRM work, such as, you know, here's a site form, let's fill one out. Here's a historic property inventory form, let's fill one out. We did some of that, but it wasn't very extensive. Here's, you know, a permit, let's work on filling this out, because you have things
actual
you need to do.
Practical application.
Things like that. And we got some of it, but not as much.
Okay.
I think that would be helpful.
So, you would, for your own, like, if you were talking to yourself, 2+ years ago, you would say, go seek out learning how to do these kinds mm-hmm. of things.
Sure.
All right. And what is your career goal in CRM? Whether that's, you know, a particular theoretical thing or a position you'd like to see yourself in?
Well, I'm interested in historic archaeology, but my overall career goals in archaeology won't be to stay in CRM. I would like to be a professor eventually, and CRM is just what I'm doing right now.
Okay. Would you incorporate, having made the comments about how you would have liked to have learned?
Preparing myself.
Uh-huh.
Yes,
would you
sure.
bring those into
yeah.
your teaching? Okay. All right. And if you could give an undergrad thinking about CRM one piece of advice, what would it be?
You really have to like what you do, because there's no money.
All right. That is very good, sound advice. Thank you, Ian.
That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for the podcast, which can be found at www.digtech-llc.com/podcast. If you like the show and want to comment, please do. You can leave comments about this or any other episode on the website or on the iTunes page for this episode. You can also email me at archaeowebby@gmail.com or use the contact form on the podcast webpage. If you'd like us to answer a question on a future episode, email me at archiewebby@gmail.com. Again, use the contact form on the podcast page of the website, or tweet your questions using the hashtag CRMArcPodcast. Please share the link to the show wherever you saw it. If you share CRM archaeology-related items on Twitter or Facebook, be sure to use the hashtag CRMArc so the community can see it and comment on it. If you'd like to subscribe to this podcast, you can do so on iTunes or on Stitcher Radio. You can also type the name of the podcast into your favorite podcasting app and subscribe that way. Thanks to our guests today, Tom King and Alan Garfinkel, and also thanks to our Profiles in CRM segment attendees, The Man in the Hat and Ian Lewis. Thank you to Sarah and Ashley for helping out with the Tom King interview, and thank you to Ashley for getting the Ian Lewis interview. And finally, thanks to the listeners for tuning in, and we'll hopefully see you in Austin. If not, we'll see you in the field. Goodbye.